Well, thank you very much for all coming here this morning. Yesterday evening we had an Andy Murray semi-finals competition. And this morning we have the English Sun as competition. So it's very good that you've all sacrificed that to be here this morning. This morning's discussion is about transforming world views. And we're very lucky to have today on our panel John Clark, who many of you will know was a former chairman of the Scientific and Medical Network. Paul Devereux, who has the great honour of being married to Sharla, who of course you do all know. And David, who needs no introduction whatsoever. And what we're going to do this morning is I'm going to invite each of the panel members to say something for between 10 and 15 minutes, and I will make sure they do not go over their 15 minutes. Then I will invite them to have a little bit of discussion between themselves, and then we will be opening the discussion to all of you. So there will be at least half an hour, if not 45 minutes of discussion with all of us participating. So without further ado, I'm going to invite John Clark to start with his presentation. And John, could you just say, for those who don't know you, just a few short sentences about yourself so they know where you are coming from.
Well, I joined the network about 15 years ago. I almost said minutes. The lovely Freudian slipper. I joined it because my career's been in philosophy, in teaching philosophy and the history of ideas. And as with the scientists here who mentioned last night, that there wasn't really much opportunity within my professional work to do the things I really wanted to do. And one of them was Jung. I wanted to study Jung, teach Jung. His ideas, not his psychotherapy so much. And I found that the network was very interested in Jung as well, and so I joined and have been and it's really made a big difference to my life. But I'm basically an historian of ideas, and I'm going to approach today's topic rather in that mode. But I want to ask some questions of the SMN, because I'm no longer chair. I can stand outside, relatively speaking, and just see where we're going on worldviews. What have we got to offer? But it's always nice to start these occasions with a minute's silence. It helps to concentrate the mind wonderfully. And also, I think it's nice to start with a quotation from G.K. Chesterton, and that's what I'm going to do. And I can't remember actually where this came from. Perhaps somebody can tell me. There are some people, and I'm one of them, and that's Chesterton speaking, who think that the most practical and important thing about a man is his view of the universe. For a landlady considering a lodger, it is important to know his income, but still more important to know his philosophy. Now, I think we can take it from that. If we substitute the word, worldviews for philosophy there, you can see that it's getting quite near to home there. And I think it's also plain from the quotation that Chesterton took worldview seriously, very seriously, even above the question of income. I would also say, in the light of last night's proceedings, that it's clear that the SMN takes it seriously too. I think, like the post office, we do many things. They all have their own independent consciousness and parapsychology and so forth. But they all, I think, point to one thing. If I might do another little quote, this time from Kierkegaard, purity of heart is to will one thing. And I think the one thing, if one was to choose one thing, that occupies the scientific medical network, it is the question of worldviews. And in a sense, as I see it at any rate, it points to that. And looking again at this lovely book, Wide Horizons, which was mentioned several times last night, I'd just like to quote one, although there are many articles in it on a very variety of interesting topics. I think they all point to the one thing. And this is the opening sentence from Mark Woodhouse's contribution on the subject of worldviews in transition. Now, it sounds rather like the title of this weekend in a way. And he, of course, is the author of a very admirable book called Paradigm Wars, some of you may know it, an excellent book. He spoke at one of our conferences, Beyond the Brain, some years ago, I seem to remember, Peter. And I remember he gave a secular blessing to everybody, which I thought was rather nice. Anyway, this is what he says. Deep transformational challenges are currently at work that I believe will result in a fundamental shift in our Western, if not global, worldviews in the early decades of the new millennium. And of course, he was speaking in 1999. Well, I think that that could also be said now. I think the same kind of comment could be made now. And I was very privileged to be on the board at a time in 2008, at the time of the great crash and crisis in the banking and so on. The world was coming about down our ears and taking the ground from under our feet. And we decided then, there was a suggestion put forward by David and by Claudia Nielsen, that the network should face up to the crisis, contribute not to the crisis, but to the possibly to the solution of the crisis. We kept our fees at the same level, I have to say, at that point. That we should examine the possibility of an alternative, better worldview. That was what we decided at that the meeting of the board in, I think it was January 2008. David has got a good memory, he might remember. I think it must have been 2008, because the crisis, if I recall, began in 2007. And there were many other crises, and many people were making very similar points, that we need a new worldview. Things are getting really bad, and it's not all superficial things. There's not much point in tidying up the banks. You know, we need to tidy it up and look profoundly at the issues that underlie the whole thing. As a result of that meeting in 2008, the SMN, particularly as edited by David and Oliver Robinson, produced this book, A New Renaissance. So A New Renaissance is really like a new wider horizon, ever wider horizons, in a sense. And its subtitle is Transforming Science, Spirit and Society. And those of you who are fairly new, you can buy this. It came out just a couple of years ago. Very excellent collection of writings on a very similar kind of new Renaissance, as we call it there. And in that, David's written an introduction. I'll just read a short passage from that just to give you a flavour of it. The recent financial and economic crisis reflects not simply a crisis of confidence, a crisis of trust, but more profoundly, a crisis of values, a crisis of meaning and purpose, which means a crisis in the predominant Western outlook or worldview. Since it is our collective values and attitudes that have got it to this point of meltdown, this situation, I believe, calls for a fundamental re-examination of the values that we've lived by in the past 50 years. Now, in the light of that, I'd like just to ask two sorts of questions. One is there any place in our world today for a new worldview? We seem to be undergoing weekly new crises, particularly in the Middle East at the moment, but throughout the world, of upheavals and disillusionment with everything pretty well. The age of progress seems long past. And possibly the age towards progress towards a worldview, maybe long past. And I wonder, is it possible for us to think deeply now in a global context about a new worldview, an alternative worldview, to face the crises that confront us? And what contribution can the SMN make to this? We're a little army, aren't we? Like the Pope, we don't have many divisions. Remember, Bismarck made that comment about the Pope. We're very small. And but still, we're lively, and we have many things to say. And is it something that we can do, and how we do it? And we've started to do it in 2008, and we proceed in the same direction. Looking recently at a book on this subject and on the worldview, subject of worldviews, and I came across this statement: we now live in a post-worldview era in which the great Western, not the great Western railway, in which the great Western search for foundational metaphysical truths about the world is at an end. The party's over. Well, that's quite a statement. I've only got about 10 minutes more to discuss this with you, but I hope to be able to... And I was going to next say that something like, when did the party begin? And, of course, it began a long time ago, perhaps in Greece, perhaps somewhere else, who knows. But to cut a long historical story short, it began with Kant, but so many modern things did, and he invented the word Weltanschauung. At least he used it for the first time in a technical sense, or in a semi-technical sense. And he meant the compass of our sense perception of the world. Our sense perception is unified in a way. So it had a relatively limited meaning, and he thought that he was talking about the universal characteristic of human nature. But after him came a series of quite remarkable developments in philosophy, in Germany in particular. And the names of Fichte, Schelling and Hegel immediately have to be said in this context. They picked up this idea of a world outlook, a world picture, has various ways of saying itself, this Weltanschauung. They attempted to construct world views in their own terms, but terms which they believed could be established on the basis of universal philosophical truths. And that this would not only encompass the whole world in a systematic, orderly system of thought, but also provide some sense of guidance in life and the direction in which life is going, some purpose, some telos, some teleology that's entered into the whole thing. In their case, it was the grandiose idea of absolute spirit. And that was the summation of the grand procession of historical worldviews that they depicted. And in many ways, this became the key theme of German philosophy for the next 200 years. In fact, so much so that it was almost synonymous with the word worldview was almost synonymous with the word philosophy. If you did philosophy, you pursued worldviews. And if you did worldviews, you were a philosopher. And that was the way it was. I have to say that on this side of the channel and across the Atlantic, in the English-speaking world, there was a certain amount of scepticism about this, you know, these rather grandiose metaphysical philosophical monstrosities that they produce now and then. So the Anglo-American philosophers have rarely given it any attention. Although I would say that the concept of a paradigm, which of course is very much part of the Anglo-American tradition, and the notion of conceptual schemes and such like, does seem to touch on it in a tangential way. But there does seem to be a kind of cultural divide at work here. This, again, is sort of cutting a long story short, but the grand and ambitious ideals of these early romantic philosophers at the beginning of the 19th century really didn't become in any plausible sense fulfilled. The search for a universal philosophy which would ground all human beings in a single worldview simply faded away in time. History marches on and leaves these ideas behind because history changes people's minds, changes people's language, changes people's values. And this led towards two things, a form of subjectivism. For example, in Kierkegaard, who sat at the feet of Schelling in Berlin, he said that truth is subjectivity. Truth is subjectivity. In other words, everybody's got their own truth, you could say. Nietzsche, shortly afterwards, said, there are no facts, there's no objectivity, there's no truth, only perspectives, points of view, opinions, you might say. But there's no truth, there's no facts, there's no objectivity, there's only points of view, perspectives. In fact, it became known as perspective. It also became known as relativism, because this is the beginning of the end of the great ideals that the Romantic philosophers set in motion. Indeed, one could say that before that, in the Enlightenment, with science at its heart and rationalism at its heart, the same kind of ideals set, and people now talk about the end of the Enlightenment project, this great project to discover truth about the world and discover a worldview which will satisfy everybody and direct everybody towards the right values, this now seems to be, in many people's views, at an end. And the cultural phenomenon which I think now embodies this relativism, this subjectivism, is called postmodernism. And postmodernism means many things, and I don't think I can really give a whole adequate account of it in a few minutes. But I would say that in many ways it does represent the end of something. In fact, the notion of end actually became a word in the language, or endism, You had the end of philosophy, the end of science, the end of Christianity, the end of the Enlightenment. You know, you name it, it's got an end coming to it. Or death, you know, the death of man, for example. Foucault talked about the death of man. You know, after, echoing, of course, Nietzsche's, the death of God, after the death of man. You have the death of, death of God, you have the death of man, and then you have the death of science and all the rest of it and everything. The party's over, as it were. And one thing in particular that seems to be over is the idea of what have come to be called grand narratives, big stories. And the person who enunciated this was a French philosopher by the name of Jean-François Lyotard. He said that what characterizes, he actually wrote a book, a treatise on postmodernism for the benefit, at the request of the Canadian government. It's very interesting, isn't it? He said that postmodernism is incredulity towards meta-narratives. Now, that needs a little unpacking, doesn't it? Incredulity, well, simply, you know, skepticism about the possibility of grand narratives, big stories that encompass everything. We live in a plural world. Pluralism becomes a catchword of modernism. Postmodernism, that there's a diversity of possible ways of thinking, speaking, theorizing about the world, and no single one can put itself up to be the final answer to the issues that are being raised. And moreover, Lyotard not only took the view that these big stories are illusions, you know, they're grand illusions, not just grand narratives, they're grand illusions. He also said that they're dangerous. Because what they do is they suppress diversity, they suppress individuality, they suppress freedom, they suppress liberty. Because what they do is they construct a framework of meaning to which people feel obliged to, or forced to, even at the end of a gun, to subscribe to and to follow. And that is a form of tyranny. So grand narratives, worldviews looked at in that way, are tyrannical and oppressive. Others followed it, not just Lyotard. Derrida, for example, said that language, his famous deconstruction, implies, amongst other things, that language is always changing, it's slippery, it's mobile, it has no essence, no fundamental basic foundations on which it's the meaning of words and language and speech, etc., rest. It's always on the move. And there's indeed nothing outside language either. There's nothing outside the text. It all sounds very outrageous.
John, you've got a couple of more minutes.
Thank you. We're all storytellers. And as Feyerabend said, the philosopher of science, anything goes. Postmodernism stands for some kind of grand pluralism. Now, in many ways, I think you might say, well, what's this got to do with the SMN? Well, I think in many ways, this approach, whole approach, is symbiotic with what we have been doing and what we continue to do in the SMN, which is to look at neglected knowledge, to look at suppressed knowledge, to look at ideas which have been marginalized, to look at areas of thought which seemingly have become outdated. And in other words, to be liberated from the orthodox, oppressive grand narratives that beset us. And I think a lot of the things that were said last night, for example, by Paul, about wider horizons, the notion of going beyond the horizons, it's not enough that we should simply teach our young to conform to what's within the horizon and to be satisfied with that. We expect them to push beyond it. And I think in this sense, postmodernism and the last 40 years of the scientific and medical network, which happened to roughly coincide, although postmodernism is dead, I should tell you. But its soul keeps marching on. Sorry to disappoint you. But its soul somehow is invested in what we do, which is that we are tolerant, as Peter was saying last night, our guidelines, our toleration, openness to difference, openness to controversy, openness to oriental ideas, openness to forbidden knowledge and so on. And that's, I think, where we stand. And I think out of this comes a new kind of sense of freedom and creativity. You know, we're the music makers, as O'Shawn said. We're the music. We're the world view makers. We're the makers of stories. That's us. And that, in some sense, I think, is a very positive way out of postmodernism's rather more pessimistic and nihilistic aspect. Thank you.
thank you very much, John. And I think that raises some very poignant questions for our discussion later on. Do we need a crisis in order to change our worldview? If we have that big crisis, will it change our worldview, or will, as John said, the party be over, i.e. discussion of worldviews will be a luxury we can no longer afford? And if we are looking at new worldviews, is it one new worldview or is it many new worldviews? I don't think I'm taking questions now. We're going to have a discussion later, but I'll pick up with you on that. But now I'd like to introduce Paul, who, and again, Paul, if you could just say a couple of sentences about yourself for those who don't know anything about you.
I'll leave most of that to the delegates list, where we have a sort of, as time is short. I've been placed in the boxes of sacred places and the role of psychedelics in consciousness studies. And that pretty much, I suppose, sums up what I do get involved with. If we see sacred places as the anthropology and archaeologies of consciousness, that's really the area I operate in. Now, I've been a SMN member for about 20 years, and in that time I've occasionally gently prodded SMN to take more notice of these areas. To no good avail, I have to say. It's sort of slipped by the board. And sometimes I feel I'm operating in a parallel universe. But in fact, these areas touch on science, medicine, and spirituality and consciousness. So they should be at the centre, really, of SMN's concerns. And I do think SMN needs to broaden out its worldview a little, if it could, sometimes. Okay, first of all, sacred places. Over the last 40 years, we've got a better grip on the nature of sacred places. The first sacred places were natural features in the landscape that became venerated for various reasons. And it's interesting that Rudolf Otto in the 1920s, who coined the term numinosity, linked it specifically to place. Very important to understand and reread him on this. So it was the earth, it was the land that first whispered the idea of the holy to humanity, to the human mind. It didn't come from any religion, it came actually out of the ground itself. And the sort of places that became venerated were rocks and hills and whatever that had an unusual appearance, a simulacrum to human beings, animal shapes, faces or whatever. Another type would be landmarks, things that stand out in the landscape, became the abode of spirits and culture heroes and so on. We think perhaps Glastonbury Tor is a perfect example of that. Stands out, stood out years, centuries, millennia ago on a flat sea, very shallow sea, was very distinctive and acquired folklore to do with the last dwelling of the fairy king being the entrance to Annan, the underworld, the Celtic underworld, and so on. Some sacred places were resource locations, places where you could get minerals that could be ground up into paints of ceremonial activity and so on. And as I say, the dwelling places of spirits, places that might have had some numinous quality all of their own, particularly hilltops, mountaintops, and caves. So that was the first type of sacred place, or types of sacred place. And then minor additions were made. There'd be rock art carved at these places. There'd be minor structures, very shallow walling set up around them. Or if you think of the natural tors on Bodmin Moor, where there's a lot of erosion shale around them, it took archaeology quite a long while in the course of the last 40 years to realise some of that shale had been manipulated and it had been formed into boundaries, terminos around these places. But human beings, what they are, improving on nature, they started building their own artificial places. We call them monuments and later we call them temples. And the first megalithic monuments tended to acknowledge the earlier sacred places by being in sight of them, or by taking materials from them, the rock, the earth, the clays, and bringing them into the newly built monuments and sacred places. It's been called the pieces of places syndrome. A bit like the medieval relics of the saints being carried around. In the Neolithic, people carried pieces of places around with a similar veneration. Now, over the last 40 years, the archaeological understanding of sacred places has developed. Holism, for example, in the old days, the old archaeologists would put a frame around a sacred place or an archaeological site and just dig into it or whatever and just see it within that frame. But gradually they realised, no, hang on, it's part of a landscape. Let's look at the landscape. How does it relate to other monuments? How does it relate to topographical features? So a broadening into sacred landscapes developed. Skyscapes too, the idea of astronomy came in, particularly in the 1960s, and ever since, the idea that some places were aligned to solar, lunar, stellar events. Classic case being Newgrange in Ireland, where the midwinter sun comes up and shines down along entrance passage into the chamber in the centre and so on. A lot of developments in rock art and the understanding of its association with altered states of consciousness, that a lot of the abstract markings to do with optical and cerebral effects that occur in trance states, shamanism and so on. Also been a development in the archaeology of consciousness in that we look at sites now to see how they were used. We might go to a site, you know, with our guidebook under our arm and so on, but the people who built or used those sites were doing so perhaps in other states of consciousness altogether, and there is archaeological evidence for this. I normally give 60 or 90 minute PowerPoints on each of these topics, so forgive me slipping through. And then in the last 10 or 15 years, there's been a development into the sensory archaeology, the idea that there are other sensory modes that are relevant to the study of these places. There's other information that can be got from them. And it could be smell, it could be ambient sounds. We think, for example, the oak tree in Dodona, how it was the wind in the foliage, it was the voice of Zeus, and you heard. Things like that. We need to hear, what are the echoes? What is the acoustic resonance? And we found by doing work on that, that the resonance inside Neolithic chambers affects the frontal cortex and changes very dramatically on the exact acoustical frequency, the way the brain works, as regional brain effects. This information hasn't filtered through properly yet. And then there's the rocks themselves. Some rocks are musical, lithophones. I'm studying those intensively at the moment. Some rocks, for example, were used centuries ago by Buddhists in Japan as the sounds that came from the stones when they tapped could aid meditative states. A whole body of work here that's waiting to be done. I'm currently working on Carn Menyn with the Royal College of Art, which is the source area of the blue stones of Stonehenge. And it's a soundscape. And in about 2 weeks' time, we've got permission from English Heritage to go to Stonehenge and to test the acoustics there. Never been done before. Do the rocks speak? Anyway, there's no time, really. Second part, the other box I'm in, psychedelics. Well, 47 years ago, Sergeant Pepper, no, 47 years ago that I took my first psychedelic trip. It was a massive dose of Sandoz LSD, and it's very salutary to go away without yourselves sometimes and to go into vast areas of consciousness that normally we have no contact with. And you can't, it became clear to me then and subsequently, that you cannot have consciousness studies unless you're going to take into account this experience of expanded consciousness. It just won't happen. Our normal monophasic worldview and the worldviews that ensue from that are too narrow to encompass what is required, the perspectives that are needed to understand consciousness. Now, unfortunately, psychedelic substances over this last 40 years, indiscriminately lumped in with other hard drugs, became effectively banned in Western societies. And this curtailed research on them and the various altered mind states they can produce. Professor David Nutt at Imperial said that the making illegal of psychoactive drugs during this period caused a repression of scientific research that matched the failure of the church to look through Galileo's telescope centuries ago. Now, however, a new dawn, the situation is beginning to change legally with regard to scientific research, if not yet politically. Experiments are being done on psilocybin, LSD, dimethyltryptamine, and increasingly its natural version of ayahuasca, ibogaine, ketamine, and other substances. Therapeutic effects of these substances are being noted, and socially speaking, a buoyant psychedelic movement now exists, and it's as strong perhaps as in the 1960s, the era I hark back to. The permission for some scientific research into psychedelics is largely been through the efforts of certain groups and individuals. And in this country, I'd pick out Amanda Fielding, director of the Beckley Foundation, who's been tireless in her work in this area. This blossoming of a new psychedelic era is shown in events like Breaking Convention, the first of which was held at Kent University in 2010, in which I spoke. And it attracted some 600 delegates from around the world. The second such convention is to be held at Greenwich University in a week or two's time, and our own Bernard Carr is going to speak at that. If this wind of psychedelic change continues, we can expect to find psychedelic experience ultimately affecting science, especially physics, cosmology, consciousness studies, and much else besides. It'll help us get inside of the outside that science, as we currently have it, is studying. Unless we expand our consciousness, we will not change our worldviews, and we will never fully understand consciousness. Must be at least 15 years ago, Ralph Metzner, Charla, and I sat down with Albert Hofmann on the occasion of his 90th birthday. He lived to be 102. Completely cogent. And he had two big messages he'd put over at the dinner table. Now, one was, he said, we can measure what goes on in the brain, but the thing that becomes cognition, he said, we don't measure. It's a mystery. And he said, that's what we need to understand. And the second thing he said, and in this he was echoing Aldous Huxley and others, what we need is a new Eleusinian mystery tradition for the modern world, which would involve the use of psychoactive substances. The great Greek philosophers all tripped on LSD. Think about that. They took the natural variant of that in the Eleusinian mysteries. It's quite clear. And so the basis of our repressive Western culture started in psychedelia. And hopefully that's where it'll continue to go. Let it be. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Paul. And he has posed a very interesting question as to whether a new worldview is about values which and concepts, which John was elucidating, or whether it's about a new way of sensing the physical world or a new experience of expanded consciousness. So I will now hand over to David to give our last presentation.
Thank you, Janet. I'm going to speak from here, something on my computer at a certain point in my presentation, so I'm just going to get that up in the right place. Here it is. I'll start with many of you know that we're a parallel organization to the Institute of Noetic Sciences, and we're having a celebration, sort of joint 40th birthday, as it were, in August with the Beyond the Brain, and Marilyn Schlitz coming over And these Beyond the Brains were started at a dinner table in Chicago in 1994 with Willis Harmon, Stan Grof, and Charlie Tart, and so on, and they're still going. But Willis Harmon had this rather good phrase about the relationship between, he said that ornithology is to birds what philosophy of science is to scientists. And this is, you know, quite an interesting remark, because birds know anything about ornithology, just get on with flying. Whereas in scientists, they just got on with doing science. They, what do we need to? Why do we need to ask these questions about assumptions and world views and so on? We're just getting on with it. And this is exactly the issue which the network has been addressing right since the beginning. And if you look at the origins of the network, particularly from a scientific and a medical point of view, one of the concerns of the founders was that the young people studying science and medicine were effectively being indoctrinated into scientific materialism. In other words, there was no distinction made between the scientific method as such, as a way of inquiry, and the ideology or assumptions or presuppositions underlying the knowledge, the kind of knowledge that they were being taught. And they were being taught it as the only valid knowledge, and it invalidates any other form of knowledge and any other form of perception, which John and Paul have already referred to. And so it is monophasic and indeed imperialistic. And I regard this ideology of scientism as a form of epistemological imperialism. Because it's perpetuated down the line, because in most cases, people who teach these courses, you know, it's like the ornithology in birds, they've no idea that they have got a philosophy and that this philosophy is being passed on. Very early work was done on this by E.A. Burt, Harvard, and a book called Metaphysical Foundations of Modern Science, which came out in 1925. And that was followed up by Willis Harmon in the 1990s when they had this project called New Metaphysical Foundations of Modern Science. And so the founders were very concerned with these presuppositions and the metaphysical assumptions behind science and behind medicine. And their argument was that this should be made explicit, but also that there is very good evidence, both through research and personal experience, that there is more to life than the material world as we perceive it with our senses. And all of the founders had mystical experiences of their own. And so they knew, in a sort of Gnostic sense, a sense of gnosis, they knew that there was more to reality than was explained in terms of current science. And this is very important. So last night, for instance, Bernard was saying that the founders questioned orthodox science or conventional science, but also orthodox religion. And the story I told about Peter Leggett last night about reincarnation that would change my whole theology, you know, is illustrative of this. Then, because people, once they got into a certain way of thinking, and it applies to all of us, you know, we're reluctant to change our views, and we're therefore reluctant to look at evidence that might undermine or question the adequacy of those views. And some of the areas, this is from a very early newsletter that the founders were interested in, and in the scientific and medical network, and I'm just going to read you some of these. Evidence, not proof in brackets, of planning by or purpose of some dynamic mind other than that of any incarnate person connected with the research. Evidence, that's A. B, evidence of the existence of energies, laws, and forms of life that cannot be directly apprehended by normal physical senses. C, evidence that physical structure of living or inanimate things is dependent for its maintenance and growth on a more non-basic, non-physical field. D, well-attested instances of higher sense perception. And there was, Shafika Karagula wrote a book in the 70s called Higher Sense Perception, HSP as opposed to ESP, and she was an early member of the network. E, well-attested cases of mind functioning independently of the body, including out-of-body experiences. F, evidence of the continuity of life after death of the body. And G, more than usually conclusive cases of healing through paranormal agencies. Now, those are seven areas which you can see, if you think about it, have actually informed the program of the network, you know, for the last 40 years. And I would think that everybody sitting in this room would be interested in more or less all of these topics, and some more than others. It doesn't cover the area that Paul, some of the areas that Paul's been looking at, but that would certainly not be excluded by the interests of the founders. So what I'm saying is that there's this continuity here between what the founders were interested in and what still are the main concerns of the network. And what this really led them to think about was that we need a wider and a deeper view of life and the universe. And the worldview itself addresses really two main questions. What is the nature of the self and consciousness? And what is the nature of physical reality, or reality in a wider sense? And these two things are obviously related, because the cosmology that you have, or the worldview that you have, the world in general, will affect how you understand the human being and human consciousness, and vice versa. And so you can see that the conventional understanding and education in science is giving a particular angle on this. And it's an angle that I think personally needs to be widened out and deepened still. So the other thing to mention is that if you think of the Renaissance worldview, that was rationality informed by a rather more esoteric understanding, and also the idea of the anima mundi. And so there was a sense of a wider and deeper intelligence in which we participated. And then mechanistic philosophy took over. And since the 17th century, we've been dominated by the metaphor of the machine, which is not the case so much in physics now, but very much the case still in molecular biology. And so we still have this mechanistic metaphor, and also in medicine, which dominates the kind of structures of thinking. I think this is, again, an area. I'll talk a little bit about these various fields in a moment, but this is something that needs to be addressed. John already mentioned this notion of paradigm. This comes from the Structure of Scientific Revolutions by Thomas Kuhn, 1962. So that's just over 50 years old now. And this has been a hugely influential concept. It's been a controversial concept in philosophy of science. People have constructed it, deconstructed it, reinterpreted it, and so on. But just generally, in terms of another term for worldview, this paradigm shift, the idea of paradigm shift, has become a very powerful one. Over the period that the network has existed, a great many influential books have been written. And I just want to mention not a whole list of books, but just some of the thinkers to make you realize what kind of widening has actually taken place among those people who have absorbed these books. And I mentioned some early members of the network, like Arthur Koestler and E.F. Schumacher, for instance. Some people don't know that Koestler and Schumacher were members of the network, which they were. And then other people, this is sort of slightly random list, but you'll see why some of these people are being mentioned. Fritjof Capra, Turning Point, Tao of Physics, Hidden Connections, this whole series of books have been incredibly important. Ken Wilber, Rupert Sheldrake, David Bohm, these are all, Wilber hasn't been a member of the network, Capra has at one point, Stan Grof, Bohm Hiley as well, Basil Hiley's work's incredibly important, Richard Tarnas, Passion of the Western Mind, Seyed Hossein Nasser, Brian Ingalls was a member of the network, Willis Harmon, Dean Radin, Conscious Universe, David Fontana, and his books on survival, Anne Baring, incredibly important book that's just come out, The Dream of the Cosmos, and you should all be thinking about reading that. I believe there's a copy over there if you'd have a look at. Bede Griffiths spoke at Mystics and Scientists, New Vision of Reality. Peter Kingsley, his work on Parmenides and early Greek philosophy. Ian McGilchrist, Master and His Emissary. Larry Dossey, huge series of books on holistic non-local medicine. Brian Goodwin and Henry Bortoft and Arthur Zients, the development of Goethean science. This has been very, very powerful. And going along with this, the Gaia hypothesis. Henrik Skolimowski, honorary member, eco-philosophy. Irvin Laszlo, Chris Clark, Alan Wallace, Lawrence Lachan, Elia Prigogine is an honorary member. Marilyn Ferguson, the Aquarian Conspiracy, do you remember that? Long time ago, it's about 30 years ago, but it's a prefiguration of a lot of what we're talking about. And then our conferences have actually elaborated on a lot of these themes. Now, next year is the 37th Mystics and Scientists Conference, and the amount of material that has been expressed through these conferences is absolutely phenomenal. And same with the Beyond the Brain. So where does that leave us now in terms of the way forward? Have I got 5 minutes or
yes,
2 minutes?
Exactly
or
5 minutes,
good, right, it's on schedule. I think we're in a situation here of what some people call the politics of knowledge. And there is, as Mark Woodhouse has indicated, a paradigm war going on to some extent. You could say, well, let's have a balanced, you know, we must balance the rational and intuitive and the inner and the outer mechanism and organism and holism. But there are some places where there are fronts on this war, and one of them is the closure of acupuncture departments in universities, which has been an organized campaign on part of the quackbusters. And these are people who have an ideology of scientism, and whose agenda is to shut these things down and say that no other kind of knowledge is valid. It all has to be Western reductionist science. We can't do anything else. And one of our members is Charmian Wild. Her department has been closed down, and it's not the only one. There is Monsanto's agenda for taking over the world food supply. This is a very serious threat. Many of you will know about that. And there's a new documentary on BT cotton in India, which really takes the lid off, you know, what they've been doing there. But this is trying to go in a direction of control, of controlling everything and controlling nature, as opposed to trying to come into harmony with nature. So you have this war, in a sense, or tension between control and harmony. Summed up in some senses by a new book called The Future by Al Gore. And in it, he has a first chapter on Earth, Inc. And that's at Earth as a global corporation. And this is where the power is at the moment. And the science is mainly backing this up and paid for by these enormous companies. And then on the other hand, you have the global mind. And this is through the internet. Some of the war is going on through the internet. So that in Rupert Sheldrake, I had lunch with him this week, and he said that there are guerrilla skeptics changing all the entries on parapsychology in Wikipedia in order to give them a skeptical slant. And so Rupert, is a very creative thinker, so he's thinking of a way around this to see, you know, what we can do. But this is kind of frontline stuff. So this really is another sort of element of tension or even war. Agriculture, I've mentioned. Medicine, there's a whole other front which we'll be looking at today. Economics and the relationship between economics and ecology. At the moment, the planet is at stake. And if we continue with business as usual, then, you know, the human impact on the environment would be totally overwhelming. And so I think we are at a very critical stage. And some of you will have seen the film Thrive. If you haven't, then I recommend you have a look at it. And you may feel when you first look at it, my God, this is totally over the top. But if you actually have done any research in this area, then you'll find that a lot of what they say can be backed up by other independent research. So I think we're at a point of transition, and I think we need to be very strategic about how we try to move in the direction of a holistic, organic, spiritual outlook. But we need to be very aware that there are forces moving in the opposite direction, and there are big things at stake in terms of the politics of knowledge.
Thank you very much, David, and that raises the very important question of what is the role of us here in regard to worldviews. It was very nice to have that bit of perspective about the the role that past members or present members of the SMN have played in evolving worldviews. I'm now going to invite members of the panel to have a short discussion, maybe just 5 minutes, commenting on what each of the others have said, and then I will be opening the discussion up to the floor. I don't know whether, John, you'd like to start off on that discussion.
Yes. As one question I want to put to Paul, and that is, you mentioned at the start the idea of the holy by Rudolf Otto. Now, and you link this holy with the sacred. As far as I can recall, Otto believed that the idea of the holy was a universal category of human understanding. It's not exactly an add-on. It's the reality of being human. And I mean, do you agree with this? Do you think you can be human without having any conception of the holy or of the sacred? Could there be a society which lacks the holy or lacks sacred places, for example, holy places, etc.?
Well, you're living in it. But I don't think so. I mean, I think it's an idea I've been floating for a while. There's room for spiritual agnosticism, spiritual atheism, if you like. You don't need organized religion to be spiritual. You can get spiritual experience from a waterfall, from a work of art, from a piece of music. So I think inherently, to answer specifically, no, I don't think you can be human without a sense of the sacred within you, okay. But it can be repressed. And I would just add now that list of thinkers and so on that David gave, quite a few of those people took psychedelics. It's important to know that more than you might suspect, because they keep it quiet. And so psychedelic thinking, almost everything you've said, has originated out of that broadening of consciousness. In the more recent people, even people, I better not name names, I might get myself into trouble, but even highly respected people that have addressed SMN and so on have had psychedelic experience. And it's a dirty secret, and it should no longer be.
It needs to be outed.
Sorry.
It needs to be outed. No, but I remember I went to a meeting with Willis Harmon in Monterey in 1993, and we were talking. This is when he's talking about his worldview project, and he said that he and his friends in the 1950s had taken various substances, and that was why he got so interested in consciousness. So you're absolutely right.
Yeah. Mm.
Can I ask?
Sure.
Yes. Well, I wonder if science dominates in quite the same draconian way that you suggested. I mean, in a sense, a bit naive of me, we live in a plural society. There are lots of different worldviews around the place, it seems to me. Even scientists themselves seem to be able to, you know, live a different kind of mental life on Sunday than they do during the week. And I think in the United States, which is the most advanced scientific country in the world, you know, you get 70-80% of the people who believe in creationism. And that kind of variety and difference, it seems to me, is now a world phenomenon. It's not just local. It's not even in the West only. And so I wonder if we aren't sort of overplaying this notion, which... That science is the dominant worldview.
Well, obviously that's related to technology as well, and what informs technology, and the idea that technology is associated with control. And because what I don't like is this is the development towards a sort of surveillance society, and everything is going to be, you know, controlled and looked after. Because the I think one of the most important things about the Western worldview is individual freedom, and we're in danger. I mean, we've lost quite a lot of it already, and to the extent that the scientific view is allied with a technology of control, I think it's going into kind of Big Brother direction, and we really need to be aware of this. And so I take your point about the plurality of views, but I think if you look at the money that is controlling the system, then they are moving in this direction of ever increasing control, and regarding the human being as just a bit of software that can be manipulated in various ways. And so I think this is in Jung, when Jung said in The Undiscovered Self that the awakened human being is absolute repository of freedom and culture. And I think he was absolutely right. And I think in the SMN we have to stand for that awakened individual, that aware individual, who is as fully developed in this sense as possible.
If I could just add to that, you see, I think one of the problems, you think of David Bowie's The Man Who Sold the World, is going round rather a lot at the moment, and The Man Who Sold the World. We're selling off everything, and there's a collusion between Western governments specifically, but not uniquely, and global corporate power. And it's coalescing in a very dramatic and increasingly rapid way. And so when you see, we have to deal with things in little blocks, but, you know, if you look at the NHS, the way it's been set up to be privatisation, companies come in, and either they're already global conglomerates or they get taken over by global conglomerates. So there's a coalescing of power, just as David said. It's extremely serious, and the population generally is sleepwalking into it all. There is not enough debate. And you have the debate about GM foods. It's not a debate about whether or not they're safe to eat. You can argue that. The question is, who's going to own the food chain? It's about property. And it's about controlling people, again, as David says. And we're extremely at a real sharp point in this. And yes, it's not science as such. I'm pro-science personally. But the way science is used and the technology... You see, we're very good in the West at transporting our worldview. Most worldviews stayed in their valleys or their regional part of a country. Now we spread it out globally. We're very effective in this. It's extremely dangerous. So this reductionist worldview, the whole thing about spirituality and we shouldn't just be dualistic about it and say, well, there's mind and spirit. There's a lot of bollocks talked about that as well, you know. And then there's reductionism and there's all the rest on the other. Any experience you have as a human being comes through your brain. Let's be clear about that. It's the nature of where that experience starts that's the issue. And so we shouldn't be down on neuroscience, for example, but we should say, well, that's the TV set. Where's the studio? What about those invisible signals going through the air? More superstition. So we need to pull a lot of stuff together. But do not let's start a polarized debate between material reality and spirituality. They are totally intermixed. And it's just what we, our brains, draw out of the n-dimensional soup that we're all suspended in. And psychedelics will open that door a little bit, the doors of perception. And it'll open and let it in mind at large, as Huxley mentioned. And it's that mind at large we really need to draw on now. And soon. It's Waterloo, folks. It's Waterloo. It's really close.
Yeah, it's 1815. So it's just to add to that, I think what the direction the network has always stood for is not so much in this polarizing, as you were saying, although there are some areas of conflict, there's no doubt about it, but rather the expanding the view so that it's not as narrow as it is or not as shallow as it is at the moment, so that the same spirit of curiosity and scientific advance can be reflected, but on a slightly wider basis of assumptions.
Well, thank you very much for those observations. I'd just like to finish off this panel session by just asking each of you in a sentence, this is rather not even me, saying one, a view about what the role of the scientific and medical network is with regard to worldview, and then I will open it up to you.
Well, I think that the role is not to discover a worldview, but to create worldviews.
Okay, thank you. Paul, what's your...
I think SMN needs to expand its worldview.
Okay.
Sorry, could you say that again, Paul?
I said I think the SMN should expand its worldview.
I think we can provide a forum for the exploration and development of these ideas, along with other organisations.
Thank you very much. Now, I'd really like to open this up to all of you. I can see your, you've put your name, your...
Ask the first question.
And then we'll come to you.
Yes, I thought this was really very interesting. And bearing in mind, I see if I can articulate what my question is probably. Bearing in mind this idea of recapitulation in the development of humanity physically, say, as the fetus develops, and bearing in mind also what Jung says in terms of individuation as the awakened person becomes conscious and a real person in all its potential, comparing the development of the individual human being with society at large and civilization at large, do you see a narrative playing itself out with the developments that we are experiencing worldwide in terms of what Chardin called the noosphere? In other words, this development towards something much greater outside our control, outside our power, but which unconsciously perhaps we are thriving towards in the light and in the shadow. In other words, in the light of our achievements, internet and so on, and also in the shadow of the points that you both make in terms of repression and control and so on and so forth. Did you understand what I'm asking?
Mm. Are we heading somewhere? Who would
is
like
there, is there a narrative?
I'll take that one also. One of the books I reviewed in the last issue was called Global Awakening and by Michael Schacker. I don't know how many of you noticed it, but it's well worth looking at, and because he goes back to the Enlightenment and he describes the decades over which it took for the Enlightenment worldview, as it were, to emerge and the various types of resistance to it. And then he describes the origins of what he calls the organic shift, the shift to a more organic worldview in Kant, Goethe, and indeed the German philosophers mentioned by John. And so I think there is a direction also towards more empathy, something we haven't mentioned, Jeremy Rifkin and others, and compassion. So the connection that we have technologically, I think, potentially is also being reflected in a greater sense of empathy and concern, also for future generations. And so I think but equally I think there's another agenda, as I mentioned, which is trying to prevent this from happening. So I think what we represent is very much in the Théâtre de Chardin and this sense of global awakening and transition to a wider and deeper view. But arriving there is by no means self-evident.
I'll just go back to my Waterloo metaphor. It's a damn close run thing. There are forces, and one force will set up its equal and opposite force. And we're seeing a collision of that occurring right in our times. And unless we clear our thoughts and see it, one or the other is going to go through. At the same time, there's a third thing coming down, and that is climate change, which will change a lot of the equations in any case. And we still, I think, even me, sometimes think of climate change as something that's going to happen. We're right in the middle of it now, and it's going to get worse. The dominoes are going down throughout the world. In fact, agriculture, crop yields this year are a third down across the world. It's going to affect people in poverty even more than the rich West. But it's going to affect us all. It's going to affect energy. There's a whole load of things happening, and it's like a third referee, if you like, coming down on these other warring polarities.
Thank you very much. I'd like to, well, first of all, I promised the gentleman over there who put his hands up first. If you could say your name first, that would be great.
So my name is Barry Tomalin. I think I was prompted partly, Paul, by your comment about the current crisis, and particularly also about David's comment about the reductionist Western view. My area of work is primarily management education, international management education, which, as you know, is partly influenced, mainly influenced by mechanistic principles, mainly coming from the States, but also increasingly by holistic principles, but not enough yet. What I'm aware of it is that everything I read and everything I look at and everything I train is entirely Western dominated, but totally. I'm also aware that the balance of the world is changing, that we're now moving to a world, maybe in the next 50-100 years, where China and India will have a much greater say, if you like, in how the world operates, and if you like, what the Western world can get away with. I'm not seeing Indian thinkers, and I'm not seeing Chinese thinkers particularly, because of the lack of translation, I think, and with Indian lack of publication. I'm not seeing massive inputs of what the thinking is in those two continents appearing in the Western world, and I'm certainly not seeing it in the output of the scientific and medical network. And I'm wondering if one of the ways forward, David, is to look at the possibility of incorporating a much more focused and much more focused research and invitation possibly of people in the future from the subcontinent and also from China to be able to input into these discussions, because I believe they may have some of the antidote that Paul feels is so desperately needed. Thank you.
Yeah, just a very brief comment. I think it's very interesting, because if you look at the Western views of Nehru in particular, you've got Nehru and Gandhi were in a different sort of... Nehru was science, technology, let's go for it. Whereas some of the other people like Gandhi and Radhakrishnan, they were trying to formulate things in more of a wider Indian culture. And the same thing's happening at the moment. There's a revival of Confucianism in China, but also there's a huge conversion of communist Christianity. And so this obviously going in the opposite direction. So I think, you know, Martin Palmer has written and spoken quite a lot about this. So I think that's a very good suggestion to try and see what new thinking is coming out of those areas. Thank you.
Can I suggest we keep the questions and the answers short, because there's loads of people.
Can I just answer that?
Yes, please do. Yeah.
Yes. I think that the question... I'm sorry, I didn't catch your name. Hello, Barry. Yes, I think you may have underestimated the degree to which the East has influenced the West. So we have rather kept it under wraps in the sense that it's been sort of the unspoken truth, in a way, that from the Enlightenment onwards, so many of the great developments in the West were anticipated and indeed influenced from the East. That's the first thing I would say. The other thing is, you may know this book by which I've just finished, Martin Jakes, when China Rules the World. And I think the point he brings out very strongly is actually David just touched on it, which is that the Chinese now are and the Indian too, I think, possibly to a similar degree, are very aware, now increasingly aware, of their own cultural heritage, which has been suppressed in the past by the dominance of Western culture. And I think that we're in the process, so Jakes thinks, of the tables being turned. So I think you can see history gradually turning around here from West to East in all sorts of ways, not just commercially and economically, but also culturally and perhaps and spiritually. It's already happened spiritually. I think the West is suffused with Oriental spirituality now, but in other cultural ways as well.
If I could just add to this, it's important, I think, we understand what the West took from its first contact with Oriental philosophy and religion. Because of a senior moment, I can't remember the title, but I'm reading a book now that analyzes just what happened. Who were the first people to introduce the idea of Zen to the West, for example, and a lot of others. And it's disturbing reading, actually. So that even the culture that suffuses now, we are aware of this stuff, how much of that is authentically based on authentic Oriental philosophy and religion? And how many people buy into it, even in the Orient, you know, now, because of the West, it's like an echo comes back. So it's a big issue. But I'll try and review that book for
yeah, please. For the
Di. Mm.
This is almost a non sequitur, so I'll do it very, very quickly. But something that changed my perspective hugely this year was going to the Ice Age Art Exhibition at the British Museum and seeing these artifacts, these figurines and so on, that went back 40,000 years. And the most moving of the lot, and it had me in tears, was the bone that had been made into a flute. They had music. They had music. It was the most wonderful thing, and that's 40,000 years ago. So just change, a sudden change in temporal perspective, it gave me anyway, but that is a non-sequitur.
Yeah, I could just say that we're studying all that stuff now. They use stalactites as well in the Paleolithic caves. Die. They use stalactites in the Paleolithic caves for music, and you can see the percussion marks, and they mark them. We're looking very much into ancient music as part of archaeoacoustics. That's what goes with it. And if you read Time and Mind, you'll find a very perceptive review of that exhibition at the British Museum.
Beata, have you got the...
Yes, my name is Beata Bishop. At the beginning, the question was asked whether we need a strong kick to reach the paradigm shift. Well, I'd like to link up to that and somewhat to what Paul said a moment ago. My feeling is that nature always has the last word. And we can sit here till Christmas and discuss theoretical points, but just look at a few things that are happening now, which are already nature's answers. What I have in mind is, for instance, that Charles Darwin wrote that all life on Earth depended on 20 inches of humus. That is now down to 8 inches, and it's running out. Look at the death of the bees all over the world. Look at the growing antibiotic resistance in humans. Put them all together. And if I may be a little fanciful, it's as if Gaia were shrugging her shoulders and saying, okay, you wanted this. If this happens, I can imagine, forgive me for saying this, but a pandemic that wipes out an awful lot of us so that it will be possible for the Earth to support the remainder. And finally, I'd like to remind you of a saying which Greenpeace used some years ago, and it's apparently a North American Indian saying. When you've cut down the last tree, when you poisoned the last river, when you caught out the last fish, only then will you realize that you can't eat money. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm going to go straight on with questions at this stage because there's so many of you. Horace and then the man at the back.
Is this working or shall I shout?
It's working.
Right. Because I will be ultra succinct, I will make 4 points. First, general relativity and quantum cosmology, arguably the summits of science, are not reductionist. Second, subject to discussion with Julian, ideologies are closed and pathological, but worldviews, particularly non-smutty holism, may be open and creative. Third, Wittgenstein, philosophical investigations. We agree not in conclusions, but in judgments. And, on certainty, there are some things that are not knowledge because we can't not know them. Finally, for those like myself who aren't prepared to risk substances, there are the arts, sciences, and human relationships. I've always found them a more than adequate antidote to sanity.
Very good. Can I say something? Very quickly, because we're really short of time.
Right, I just wanted to say that I entirely agree with that point. I think that, I'm really wanting to pick up the discussion I had with you earlier, David, which is that I think there's a danger of stereotyping and reifying reductionist deterministic science, because so much that seems to me to have been going on in science in the last 20, 30, 40 years has been moved away from it. Talks complexity theory, systems theory, chaos theory, cosmological ideas, the black hole, the multi-universe, all these things that I've mentioned, and many more, and in biology as well, are not really, strictly speaking, reductionist or even particularly materialist, I beg your pardon.
But the cultural worldview that's occurring underneath, it's not permeating the worldview of the West.
Well, I don't know.
Most people believe in free will. Most people believe in free will.
We're going to come to this in a minute. Who's who? Yes.
David mentioned ecology.
ecology and agriculture and the reduction of food, you never mention about the population of the world and empowering of the women by educating them in the first place.
Yeah, it's a very good point. In a short, 10, 15 minutes, one can't mention everything, but that is a terribly important point, especially in relationship to the development of culture and the culture of empathy, too. And this, because this, more women are educated, the fewer children they want.
Yes. But there's an economic factor with it as well.
My name's Tony Judge. I'm a professional collector of world views. namely, I have profiled them over 30, 40 years. My interest is in the fact that Gregory Bateson said that we are our own metaphor, and I would like that to apply precisely to SMN and precisely to the context in which we're functioning at the moment. So, I'm struggling for time to be able to speak, and I need to speak briefly, etc., etc. But the configuration resembles the House of Commons, where at question time, people sort of standing up and sitting down, trying to get attention in order to be able to speak. So there is something in the communication process in relationship to worldview, which I would like to talk about. John spoke about need for a new worldview. And my argument, I think, is that we're not going to get a new worldview. There will be a multiplicity of worldviews. And the role of SMN, I would argue, is to create a meta perspective on the ecology of worldviews. That's... instead of arguing for this is good and that's good, or this is bad and that's bad, which we can all agree or disagree on, I think there's a case for looking at the ecology and recognizing that there are bad beasties out there, dinosaurs and so forth, and other sort of good beasties and so forth. But there's no point getting hung up on which kind of beastie you like or you don't like. SMN needs to look at a meta perspective on the ecology, in my view. And there the paradox is that other people will disagree with me, and we're not processing agreement and disagreement in any scientific kind of way. We're simply declaring this is right, that's wrong, and we need to move on. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Okay. I've lost where the microphone is.
Here.
Yes. Hello. Hello, yes.
Okay. My name is Amalia Carly. And this is the first time I'm here. I just had some associations. First, very happy that you named the film Thrive. I hope everybody looks at it, and also the homepage, because there are scientists in the United States, hard science, engineers, architects, who are talking in this in a new movie, that the documentary that is questioning the 9/11 worldview that we were imposed, because they are analyzing what happened and they are out from engineering and architectural knowledge, they cannot see that this was something that came from outside that bombed the Twin Towers. And there are also professional psychologists, many professors from diverse universities in the United States who are again confronting this idea, this, in a way, worldview that the United States with Bush tried to impose on us. But what I wanted to comment on is that you've been saying also that the East has influenced so much Western thought. And because I was born in Argentina and I belong to this world part, I wanted also you to remember that many cultures that didn't write down, they didn't have philosophers who wrote books like in Eastern and Confucian in China, they still contributed and still contribute to this ecology of world views that we have to take in as our heritage as human beings. And being a practitioner of Qigong through many, many years now, and cherishing that view as well, I am at the same time a little bit afraid of some things that may come from China, if they are, or from other cultures, if they are worldviews that are imperialistic. I think many cultures have gone very close to Mother Earth, very humble, didn't write big books, honored the woman, the womb, the Mother Earth, and did not impose. We may learn from them as well. Mm. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yeah.
I would just say to that, that's why the anthropology and the archaeology of consciousness is a very important exercise for the West to do, to contact that very undocumented wisdom, if you like. Mm. Very important.
Hi. My name's Edmund Davey. I want to very briefly reinforce really what Beata said about when she mentioned the diminution of the soil of the earth, and also something that David said about human population growth and its unsustainability, really. Lester Brown of the Earth Resources Institute recently said, referring to the growth of human population prediction, he says, 9.2 billion people by mid-century will not happen for two reasons. It will either not happen because we get sensible, or it will not happen because we don't. Either way.
Very good. Thank you very much. If you pass that on to him. Yeah. And yes, you're back.
Hello, I'm John Kidson. It seems to me that, in the politically speaking, we have scientism on one hand and fundamentalism on the other. To take a Buddhist metaphor, shouldn't we be looking for the middle way of reconciling these two extremes?
Thank you very much.
Thank you. David Russo. I would like to respond to Anthony Judge's point about an ecosystem of worldviews. I think that's a very valid perspective, and it's exactly what we should pursue. He mentioned Gregory Bateson, who's also a hero of mine. I'm also from the systems movement. And I think from a systems point of view, I think the ecology metaphor is very powerful. But I do think we need to take account of the fact that within ecosystems, there are rules that are part of nature. There are laws of nature that operate. So there's gravity, and there's evaporation, and there's air pressure, and all the normal processes of nature, which sets the boundaries for what kind of ecosystem can be established. And there are many points of stability that you can configure within those parameters, but the parameters determine ultimately which stable points are possible. And I think in terms of our worldview, in the spiritual aspect of it, we also need to find the laws of nature that set the boundaries on what is possible and what is not possible, and resist a slide into a kind of absolute relativism about values and about facts, and especially about metaphysical and spiritual truths. I think they are out there without us having to say we're going to discover rules that have to make what everybody thinks conform to what we think. Ecosystems are not like that. They are very diverse within nature, but still there are rules that apply to them. And I think we can discover them within a kind of spiritual version of science. I think that we're in a very early stage of trying to develop that, but I do think it is possible. I think that's the good news amongst all of this bad news, is that there's a lot of scientific work and systems scientific work going into the subject. There's now a research institute at the Free University of Brussels that is devoted to worldviews research. It's called the Leo Apostle Center for Multidisciplinary Research. And the Society for the System Sciences is taking a lot of interest in this and starting to ask the pertinent questions. I think that's an important point, that other organizations are also starting to ask these questions. One question recently came up in the system sciences that said, there's now a kind of a truce between the postmodernists and the hard scientists. So the science wars have kind of come to a truce. The question is not whether postmodernism is dead. The question is, who's going to appoint the new administration? And that's the bit that we have to work on, is now that there's a truce, how do we establish some kind of basis that will give us a sustainable future? I think to do that, we have to figure out how to talk about worldviews, how to characterize them, and how to explain our worldviews to each other so that we can have a constructive dialogue around this subject. I and others are working on this, but I think that the SMN can make a major contribution through the kind of forum that David is proposing for getting a dialogue going between worldviews with a view to establishing one that has as sound a foundation in the area of spirituality and ethics and aesthetics as we have today within science.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
I don't know who else has got the We've got time for perhaps two more.
Jackie. I want to question the very quest that the SMN has set itself of seeking a new worldview. Everybody, every individual in every culture has a worldview, even if they don't know they have and therefore don't articulate it. They act on it. Even to see, the physical act of seeing requires your brain has an internalized worldview, or you couldn't see. It's simply a reflection of your perception of reality. And therefore, really, worldview is, in fact, related to any individual or society's perception of reality. Even the Taliban say they are seekers after truth, so it's about truth as we see it. Mm-hmm. Now, the SMN, in fact, doesn't need this as a mission because it's always been its mission in an indirect sense that we, in fact, are seekers after truth. Truth approached through the scientific method and any other approach that we may feel is valid. And where we're different is we think that some other approaches through the arts, through spirituality, may indeed be valid. That's our difference. The one thing we are not going to be guilty of, I think, is relativism. I think Pilate was the first relativist to say, what is truth? I think he implied that there is no truth. To think we possess truth is dangerous, but it's even more dangerous to think that there isn't a truth out there. Yeah. And having two approaches is perfectly valid. I'm a lawyer, and English law has two kinds of law. It has equity and it has law, as it, specifically law. It doesn't result in any great confusion, perhaps a little bit in the past before the fusion of the jurisdictions. We have two kinds of approach to one quest for justice, and that in our very different kind of scientific world is the same thing with two aspects. And I would like to say that we actually are already engaged in this. And when the paradigm shift comes in any society, it comes when the old view is no longer defensible, and it comes very quick. It's actually all the dominoes are preparing to fall. And I think when the shift comes, it's sudden, and it's when the old point is not defensible. And I would just make one other point in relation to something that came up and was raised by a gentleman there, and that is about the East and the West. I think we're now really a global society. We have taken a great deal of Eastern thought, and they have embraced wholeheartedly our capitalist system, our technology, and some of our values, and as David pointed out, even our Christian religion, because that's absolutely growing in China. Everybody knows it's strong in Africa, but it's very strong in China to a degree that is not realized by us or comforting to the regime there. But I think that the future is actually brighter than we think.
Thank you very much. We've got time for one more brief comment, and then I'm afraid we're going to have to close.
Okay. Well, I'll make it brief. Hello, everyone. My name's Ollie Robinson. My first SMN conference back in, well, it was a while back. I came in late. It was a Mystics and Scientists conference, and I came in to the middle of Chris Bache's talk, where he was describing at great length his experience of taking LSD. And I was amazed, because I'd not seen this before. I was young at the time, and I came into this lecture hall of very distinguished-looking people, all listening in a very non-judgmental way to this gentleman describe, over the course of 45 minutes, a trip. And this was brilliant, and one of the reasons I joined, because I thought, if there's a group that's that non-judgmental out there, I want to be a part of it. It then led to a little contretemps in the network review, where Chris Bache put a piece in, and somebody else put a piece in saying psychedelics aren't good. And that was the last I heard of psychedelics in between then and now in the SMN, probably because it splits the jury in the SMN. Some people like it, some people don't, whereas there are some things we can all agree on. So I do think that that would be a good thing to reintroduce to the SMN. And I think perhaps one of the reasons we don't is that taking a psychedelic is doing something. It's not talking. We're really good at talking. whenever I come to SMN events, there's loads of talking. And in fact, that's one of the reasons I don't come to as many as I used to, because there's so much talking. And I'm more into doing at the moment, not necessarily psychedelics, but just, you know, doing stuff, whether that's a pain, you know what I mean. So I think that nothing ever happens through talking. Talking lays the groundwork for then doing something. But the SMN, I think, in order to embrace its own worldview, which says that we need to kind of bring in action as well as discussion and do things to make the world better, has to work out how within its events and publications it can reflect doing as well as talking.
Thank you very much.
If I could just address that point briefly. And that's absolutely true what Ollie says. And believe it or not, I have been trying to move SMN in that direction for some time. We are the recipients of worldviews, whether we like it or not. And there is a general perception that psychedelic experience is somehow delusion. That's the mainstream approach to it. And I think we share it to some extent, and that's why there's been resistance to it. But there's one thing that talking can do is lay the groundwork, do the action, but then discuss the results of that action. And we don't get as far as discussing the results of the action. That's one of the problems.
Well, thank you very much for your amazing contributions this morning. We've gone from the actual ecosystems of bees and soils to the philosophical ecosystem of worldviews. And I really like that concept to leave us with, the idea of the SMN being in some way someone who can hold communication between different worldviews in accordance with the spiritual laws of our thought ecosystem. So I will leave you with that, and thank you very much indeed for your contributions.